Good morning. Welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. I'm Sheila Selby of the Boston Bluegrass Union, and I will be introducing today's program. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire us on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held in the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. Today, we present a special co-sponsored program with support from the Boston Bluegrass Union. The BBU is dedicated to bringing bluegrass music to New England and educating audiences about this important musical form. The organization is an all-volunteer association which produces the annual Jovel Bluegrass Festival and several bluegrass concerts throughout the year. The BBU also organizes bluegrass jams, picking parties, and bluegrass music workshops and classes for children and adults. Without the support of the Boston Bluegrass Union, today's program would not have been possible. As bluegrass music moves from its folk roots into more formal educational settings, there is a need for teaching methods and materials that empower people to participate more fully in their own musical traditions. Such methodologies must respect traditional ways of learning while also meeting the curricular needs of today's students and adult learners. Our speaker today is August Waters. As Director of Education for the Boston Bluegrass Union, he has designed innovative educational programming for children, teens, and adults. As a clinician, he has presented topics from bluegrass and jazz improvisation to the history of the American mandolin in workshops across the United States and internationally in five other countries. He is the founder of two classical mandolin ensembles, Boston Mandolins and the New England Mandolin Ensemble, as well as two music festivals, the Festival of Mandolin Chamber Music and Cape Cod Mandolin Camp. Professor Waters holds degrees in music education from Boston University and in jazz composition from Berklee College of Music. He joined the Berklee faculty in 1998, and he earned his present rank of associate professor by designing and teaching specialized curricula attuned to the improvisational needs of string musicians. Since the year 2000, his new acoustic music ensemble has trained successive generations of Berklee students in jazz bluegrass fusion music. Professor Waters will be speaking today on bluegrass, celebrating an American musical art. Also joining us is the nationally acclaimed bluegrass band, Audie Blaylock and Redline. They will perform live, alternating music with the lecture. And here they are with a bluegrass tune to start us off.
Drops won't let me forget. Each tear is a wish to be near you. It started the day that we met. A trail of tears will lead you to me if you want. And from my tears, my hopes, and my crying heart. I can't lose. choose, I guess it's too late now. I've tried to choose another love, but it's no use. Crying heart loser's nothing left for me to try. I'll always remember I love you. My teardrops won't let me forget. It's tears and wish to be near you. It started the day that we met. A trail of tears will lead you to me if you want me. And for my tears, my hopes, and my crying heart.
Audie Blaylock on Redline. And thanks to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum for inviting me here today to discuss bluegrass, celebrating an American musical art. Special thanks to the Boston Bluegrass Union for making today's concert with Audie Blaylock and Redline possible. All right. Bluegrass music has gotten quite a bit of media attention lately. Misunderstandings abound, however, particularly regarding the history of the music and its relationship to American musical traditions. Grand claims are being made, moreover, about bluegrass as a new American chamber music, claims that require us to re-examine popular conceptions about what bluegrass is and how it evolved. So, let me start by asking you, what are your associations with the words bluegrass music? Now, I understand you are a typically stolid and dignified New England audience. But if you were to call out just one word or two, free associate with bluegrass, what would you say? All right. I can see there's a bluegrass audience here because I hear Bill Monroe. That was the first thing I heard. Bill Monroe is, of course, the creator of bluegrass back in the 1930s and beyond. I heard some pop music references too, like Deliverance, dueling banjos. We also associate bluegrass with, say, the Beverly Hillbillies and Hee Haw. My point here is that the most common popular associations with bluegrass are not from the folk music world. They are from the mass media. And they are representations of rural Southern life. I have an album at home by a well-known Texas band, and on the back it has a picture of a farm and a horse plow and so forth, and a very withered, battered sign that says the name of the town, which might be completely fictional. It says Bluegrass. Of course, if you read the liner notes, the guys are actually from Dallas. And so that gives you an idea of where we are with bluegrass. Bluegrass is a creation of professional musicians. And so today is an excellent time to take a deeper look at bluegrass music, to understand the rapid changes that are causing some to view bluegrass as a new American chamber music, rather than as a form of folk art. Well, we'll need to clarify our terms and situate bluegrass within the greater context of American music. Next, we can look more closely at those changes occurring in the bluegrass world and perhaps propose some standards by which we can understand bluegrass. A single event which occurred last year has been responsible for quite a bit of attention drawn toward bluegrass. The so-called MacArthur Genius Grant was awarded to mandolinist Chris Thiele. According to the MacArthur Foundation website, Chris Thiele is a young mandolin virtuoso and composer whose lyrical fusion of traditional bluegrass with elements from a range of other musical traditions is giving rise to a new genre of contemporary music. With a broad look that encompasses progressive bluegrass, classical, rock, and jazz, Thiele is transcending the borders of conventionally circumscribed genres in compositions for his own ensembles and frequent cross-genre collaborations. End of quote. Creative genre bending, however, is quite common these days. In fact, it sometimes seems to be the primary way in which young popular musicians proclaim their creativity. It's hardly an adequate basis for this level of award. The MacArthur Foundation website gets closer to the heart of the matter when it continues. Through his adventurous, multifaceted artistry as both a composer and performer with various ensembles, Feely is creating a distinctly American canon for the mandolin and a new musical aesthetic for performers and audiences alike. End of quote. This view sees bluegrass as a contributor to a new art music, but bluegrass itself has received similar accolades going back to, say, 1995, the year Bill Monroe, the man most responsible for the creation of bluegrass music, received the National Medal of Arts, presented by President Bill Clinton. According to the website of the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Medal of Arts is the highest award given to artists by the U.S. government. It's awarded by the president to individuals or groups who are deserving of special recognition by reason of their outstanding contributions to the excellence, growth, support, and availability of the arts in the United States. Bill Monroe was also recognized before that in 1986 by a U.S. Senate resolution lauding his many contributions and declaring, "As a musician, showman, composer, and teacher, Mr. Monroe has been a cultural figure and a force of signal importance in our time." I'd like to return a little bit later in this talk to the question of the artistic merits of bluegrass music, but first let's define our terms more clearly. One of the misunderstandings I mentioned regarding the music has to do with its relationship to traditional music. Bluegrass is not a traditional form of music, but rather a musical genre created by Bill Monroe and his collaborators, and carefully assembled from different elements of American traditional musical forms. The fact that bluegrass is often confused with American traditional music is a testament to the depth of Monroe's musical education and to his creative vision. As you have heard here today, what we most often call traditional bluegrass, although it's not traditional music at all, as I said, most often consists of a quartet or a quintet, perhaps, where melodic and accompaniment roles shift between the instruments. The fiddle most often carries the melody, while the basic rhythm section sound is most often provided by bass, guitar, and mandolin, together providing a tight groove. The banjo plays a special role, often providing melodies, chordal accompaniment, and rhythmic drive all at the same time. This brilliant device, known as Scruggs-style playing, after its inventor, although if we look back a bit farther, it appears that the young Earl Scruggs may have been inspired by an African-American banjo tradition in the Piedmont region of North Carolina, where he grew up. Most central to Bill Monroe's musical fusion were three uniquely American sounds, each contributed by immigrants of Europe and Africa: Southern hymnody, Appalachian fiddle banjo music, and the blues. Reminders of Southern hymnody can be heard in the vocal stylings of bluegrass music, whose primary vocal texture is directly descended from Southern congregational singing. As you listen to our fine musicians sing their next tune, please listen to the way the melody is surrounded above and below by harmony parts. This three-part texture is borrowed from antebellum hymn collections, such as Southern Harmony and earlier editions of the Sacred Harp. Monroe and other bluegrass innovators, such as Rolf Stanley, grew up surrounded by this form of congregational shape note singing, and it's easy to hear this influence in this three-part bluegrass singing style.
Stars in the sky have told me. wrong.
Themes of love, loss, and despair are very characteristic of bluegrass songs, and especially of Bill Monroe's style. They resonate deeply because of our own experiences and because they remind us of older songs we know from the Anglo-American ballad tradition. Often in bluegrass, those sad lyrics are framed by happy, upbeat melodies. The overall message is thus one of optimism and perhaps even redemption. Even in the midst of life's miseries, we are reassured that there are better times ahead. But there's another reason why Bill Monroe recognized the potential success of this type of song. As a young man from small town Kentucky, upon moving to northern Indiana, 1929, he saw for himself the great numbers of expatriate Southerners who had moved to the industrialized North in search of work. Keep in mind, this is the era of long-distance radio broadcasting as a unifying factor within American society. In 1924, a Southern-themed radio show called National Barn Dance appeared on WLS, Chicago, Northern Station. It could be heard as far west as the Rockies, as far as south as Texas or Oklahoma. A similar show began the following year, 1925, on Nashville's WSM called The Grand Ole Opry. And it was this program in 1939 that Bill Monroe took by storm with his supercharged virtuosic blend of Americana. Hillbilly music, as it was known at the time, was popular in the North as well as the South, in part due to the large numbers of expatriate Southerners I mentioned living in the North, in the industrialized North, as well as that very human instinct we have to hold on to music as a source of personal pride, as a way of celebrating and renewing one's cultural identity, particularly when far from home. Another of the main ingredients of bluegrass, Appalachian fiddling, is descended from traditional Scots-Irish fiddle music. One must appreciate the extreme isolation of the Appalachian Mountains to understand the transition. Over generations, with little contact to sustain the older European traditions, this fiddling took on a uniquely American flavor. This was the music played by Bill Monroe's uncle, his uncle Pendleton Vandeveer, that the young Monroe internalized and then sped up to virtuosic tempos to create what ethnomusicologist Alan Lomax would later call folk music with overdrive. The final main ingredient of bluegrass, that is the blues, can be to our modern ears more difficult to identify. The blues is more than just a musical style. It is a language that permeates all of American music. It contains the echoes of the field hollers and the work songs of the African-American slave experience. And it is often heard as notes bent expressively up or down in a way that has been said to imitate the inflections of African languages. It is difficult to find an example of American music today that does not borrow liberally from the blues. Blues influence can be difficult for us to recognize simply because it is ubiquitous, but it was not always so. To understand the power of the blues within bluegrass, one has to understand America's legacy of racial segregation. If we trace the influx of African-American musical influences into the white mainstream, several milestones appear. Jimmie Rodgers in 1927, Benny Goodman in 1936, Elvis Presley in 1954, each an example of a white musician achieving commercial success by, shall we say, borrowing musical sounds invented by African Americans. Imagine, if you will, Bill Monroe as a young man in the early or mid-1930s, creating music for white audiences whose ears were not yet saturated by blues sounds. Monroe knew the blues because his musical mentor, Arnold Schultz, was an African-American blues guitarist who had come up the river to Monroe's home of Rosine, Kentucky. Monroe's combination of driving fiddle music, powerful high vocals, three-part singing, plus those expressive bent notes borrowed from the blues was electrifying. It became both popular and deeply influential, as was recognized by his 1997 induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Let's listen to Lonely River by Audie Blaylock and Redline. The picture I have painted for you so far of bluegrass is perhaps a bit academic. It's the sort of description you might have read in a history text with details essential to understanding the genesis of the music. It is a historical reality that bluegrass music was created by itinerant professional musicians as they traveled between live radio broadcasts based in far-flung cities of the South and Midwest. By the way, Audie, how far did you come today to be with us? All right, so we're continuing more than one tradition here.
Absolutely. You don't get to look like this for no reason.
I have two words for you, Cracker Barrel. Absolutely. But this description I've given you is also, as any bluegrass fan will tell you, completely inadequate. What happened next, historically, took the music out of the hands of professional musicians who created it and placed it into the hands of a community that embraced the music, sustained it through hard times, and ultimately began to reshape it. In doing so, this bluegrass community has, I will argue today, reabsorbed bluegrass music through the folk process and into the musical fabric of America and beyond. 1954 brought Elvis Presley and the beginning of the end for Bill Monroe's mainstream popularity. Even though Presley regarded Monroe highly and included his song, Blue Moon of Kentucky, on the B-side of Presley's first record, That's All Right Mama. Most popular musicians tried to adjust to the tidal wave of rock and roll's popularity by going electric or otherwise borrowing from rock. Monroe, instead, found an entirely new audience in the folk music revival and in a new network of outdoor music festivals that presented bluegrass as a form of folk art. It was at these festivals that a new institution arose to sustain the music, the bluegrass jam session. Unlike traditional sessions where musicians played, and still play, melodies together in unison, the bluegrass jam shifted focus from one participant to the next, much like jazz, with each having an opportunity to play a solo. It was this social construct, complete with its own etiquette, that empowered the community to participate in what became essentially a newly invented form of folk music. That's a strong claim I just made. That bluegrass, originally a commercial music form, has achieved the status of folk music, but it's consistent with the way ethnomusicologists view the process through which songs enter the folk music canon. First, songwriters write the songs, and perhaps they develop variations, but ultimately it is the community that decides which songs and variations will be remembered. In the case of bluegrass music, a community of enthusiasts, each person speaking the musical language of bluegrass has collectively chosen which songs will be remembered and which musical trends will survive. There's an interesting subgenre of bluegrass which has also contributed greatly to the music's popularity and survival, and that is bluegrass gospel. Drawing even more heavily than usual on those congregational singing traditions, bluegrass gospel reminds us of the time when the singing voice was the only instrument heard in the New England meeting house or the Southern Primitive Baptist Church. The finely tuned, close harmonies of great singers such as we are honored to have with us today can evoke the power and majesty of a pipe organ. Let's listen to Audie Blaylock and Redline as they perform.
I was praying to God to redeem my poor soul. When I heard the sweet voice of my loving Savior, then I started that night to make heaven my home. I heard his sweet voice so tenderly call, sinner, rise, be saved evermore. For I've not had a voice like it before. I'm glad that I heard the voice of my Savior. I know I'm redeemed by His wonderful grace. Someday when He calls, I go up to heaven, and then in that city I'll look on His face. I heard His sweet voice so
tenderly come. Sin arise me, say nevermore. I knew it must be the voice of my Savior, for I'd not heard a voice like it
before. That song gets me every time. Exploring the various branches of bluegrass, or today's trends, is far beyond the scope of today's talk, although I can make some general observations. Even more than in jazz, there remains an emphasis on knowing the tunes and the standard performance styles. Those ideas form sort of a standardized repertoire at bluegrass jam sessions across the world. At the same time, there's also an emphasis on writing new tunes, continuing the folk song tradition within bluegrass. New artists are expected to present new material, and bluegrass audiences evaluate them, sometimes quite harshly, channeling Bill Monroe when he would hear a band that he thought was perhaps borrowing more from bluegrass than it was contributing. That ain't no part of nothing. Bluegrass audiences can be brutal if they sense their traditions are not being honored. Now I'm hearing laughter from these fellows who have heard this before. They know what I'm talking about. Professional level technique remains an entry-level skill. Meanwhile, the rise of the internet has put bluegrass mentoring at the fingertips of those best able to aspire to such a high level of technical skill. I'm speaking, of course, of the very young. In just a few short years, bluegrass has become a highly competitive world, reflecting an extreme emphasis on youth culture. This poses serious challenges to the bluegrass community, i.e., as the ways in which traditions are passed from one generation to another are circumvented by the internet. The traditions themselves inevitably evolve more quickly and perhaps in a different direction. One impact is the message received by adult learners who may want to participate in their own traditions and yet find they can't play the fierce tempos easily mastered by talented 12-year-olds. These adults may have much to contribute and yet may find a place in the community through festivals and community events. But the culture of YouTube may make the music seem forbidding. For this reason, I think the empowerment of adult learners is one of the most important priorities of bluegrass education today. Another serious impact to the way that bluegrass traditions are being transmitted is posed by the rise of more formal educational settings. We know from previous research that folk music programs moving into the conservatory setting bring enormous changes, and not just to the students inside the conservatory. In fact, these conservatories carry an enormous level of influence in the way musical traditions are transmitted outside the conservatory as well. The International Bluegrass Music Association website provides a long list of colleges and universities offering bluegrass programming. The first was East Tennessee State University's program in Bluegrass, Old Time, and Country Music Studies, founded in 1982. Another is my own institution, Berklee College of Music, which addresses the needs of bluegrass musicians through specialized programming and faculty who have expertise in bluegrass as well as related genres. There is, however, no separate set of curricula or requirements, and thus no bluegrass program per se, as one prominent newspaper once mistakenly reported. The mission statement of Berklee College emphasizes helping students to identify and prepare for the realities of the contemporary music industry. And the string department's mission statement restates Berklee's long-standing commitment to training students to function at a professional level in multiple professional musical styles. Thus, a Berklee education remains multi-stylistic by definition, and bluegrass-oriented students have the same curricular requirements as all other students. Other major programs catering to bluegrass musicians include Belmont University in Nashville, North Plains College in Texas, both with commercial music programs, including bluegrass. The program closest to the traditional performing arts academy model, perhaps, maybe the New England Conservatory of Music with its major in contemporary improvisation. Here, students are encouraged to find their own path as they identify their own improvisational vocabulary and build their identities as musical performers based on their own interests as well as on historical models of performance. As we draw to the close of our program today, I would like to speculate just a little bit about what may be coming. Since the transmission of bluegrass culture has changed significantly in a short time, we might reasonably ask whether the core of bluegrass will remain unchanged and capable of inspiring continuity and growth, or will that great equalizer, the internet, make superficial crossovers so easy that the music becomes diluted to nothing in endless combinations with other musical forms? One vision of the future was provided by a recent Time magazine article entitled "The Banjoification of Pop Music," or "Why the Instrument is Everywhere." Although not specifically about bluegrass music, the article did project a vision of musical crossovers made easy by the internet. The web does, in fact, make the superficial borrowing of ideas out of their natural context quite easy, and bluegrass could, in this way, easily be diluted and done in by a million pop music crossovers. But another vision of the future can be found in the current issue of the Improper Bostonian magazine, whose cover story features the red-hot bluegrass of Della May, a quintet of young women who play with a fiery intensity that contrasts with their pop star eye candy visual image. Their music is dead serious, and it's clear they have claimed their role as storytellers to the bluegrass audience and beyond. If Della May is a measure of things to come, we can certainly count on the music to be continually renewed through its own traditions, even in the face of technological and cultural change. Finally, I would like to end this talk as we began, with a quick discussion of the artistic merits of bluegrass music. One argument sometimes made in defense of jazz music's status as a great American art form is innovation across successive generations of musicians. The same could be said of bluegrass music, although its history is shorter by 3 or 4 decades. Banjo players, for example, must first master the craft of Scruggs-style picking, but many players also explore a later and more linear approach pioneered by Bill Keith. Together, this lineage, this knowledge base, has acted as a springboard for the innovations of today's banjoists. I'm not sure bluegrass music has yet seen a Miles Davis, but David Grisman's work in the 1970s and 80s does provide a link between traditional bluegrass and today's innovations. Wonderful musicians today are exploring dynamics, timbre, harmony, and ensemble playing in a way unimaginable without Grisman's radical rethinking of the string band format. To mention just a few innovative names today, Claire Lynch, Alison Krauss, Chris Thiele, Bella Fleck, Tony Trischka. Putting aside these questions of how to measure artistic value, I think one of the greatest things bluegrass has to offer is as a model for music education within the schools. The old model of classical music education has long ago broken down as the dominant paradigm. A big part of this was educators' rethinking of the values imparted by the old ways of doing things and their desire to teach both egalitarianism and the merits of popular forms closer to students' musical experience. A new emphasis has been placed on multiculturalism and identifying and reinforcing musical traditions that exist within students' own communities. Bluegrass music has enormous potential from this perspective. It offers a window on the American musical experience, one that taps into the cultural landscape of diverse American immigrant communities. Bluegrass teaches both improvisation and interpretation. It cultivates both individualism and teamwork. It can build self-esteem through the realization of ambitious goals, in the process connecting students to their cultural roots and providing a framework for personal growth. It is not the only new paradigm for music education. Quincy Jones, for example, he's best known as Michael Jackson's producer, but he's also an important musician in his own right. Quincy Jones has a very impressive initiative to teach all of American popular music as a form of cultural studies, linking America's musical innovations to its cultural history. I'm also impressed with Mark O'Connor's vision of a new classical music education based in American fiddle styles. It is safe to say that the educational value of bluegrass, i.e. the potential bluegrass offers as a model for music education today, has barely been tapped. Thank you for coming today.
Things like this that are a little bit different. We have probably about 10 or 12 minutes left, so we're just going to play a few songs for you, if that's okay. Real quick on the banjo over here from the state of Pennsylvania, Mr. Russell Carson. Back here on the upright bass, they're both on the same diet. From Nashville, Tennessee, Mr. Austin Ward. And the tall man with the fiddle right here from the state of Maryland, Baltimore, Maryland to be exact, Mr. Patrick McAvenue.
This hurt came last. No, I don't want all of your heart once more to be with you, dear, just for tonight, to hold you tight.
Made the chair for the love he saw, for the big old tree on the land he bought. As he whittled and worked, he sang a tune, said, I'm going to be married in the month of June. It was made of wood, but made with love, it was all he could afford. He wrapped it in a feed sack and left it by her door. He said, my love, this will have to do. Gold I could buy for you. That ring of gold. She don't mind, no, she don't care. She can feel his love in the rocking chair. It was made of wood, but made with love, it was all he could afford. He wrapped it in a feed sack and left it by her door. I said, my love, this will have to do. Till the ring of gold I could buy for you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. One call to the old danger field. Thank you.
Patrick McAvenue. Thank you. Thank you very much, and thank you for allowing us to have the opportunity to play in such a very cool event. The last time we played in a church, the PA blew up, so it doesn't always work out well. Now we're going to do one more song, and thank you so much. We appreciate your attention and your attendance. And this is a great series. We were just looking at it yesterday in between sets, and so this is going to be a really cool thing. And it is a very cool thing. Thank you very much. And we're going to do a song right now that was written by Frank Wakefield. Anyone that's familiar with bluegrass, he is one of the bluegrass pioneers as well, mandolin player. He's a bit on the eccentric side, but we love him to death. He wrote this song. The name of the song is Lonesome Weary Heart, but nowhere in the song do those words appear. That would be Frank's humor. So here we go with Lonesome Weary Heart.
Come back, little darling. I'm so long since you've gone. With another you have stranger. Come back, and you've gone. I saw you in another's arms, dear. You act so strange and I knew why. He brushed your hair and kissed you softly. It broke my heart, I thought I'd die. Come back, little darling. I'm so lost since you've gone. With another you have stranger. Come back when you belong. I'm so lonesome and heartbroken since a new love you have found. If you ever love me, darling, come back, I'll be around. Come back, well, darling. I'm so lost since you've gone. With another you have strayed. Come back where you belong. Come back, little darling. I'm so long since you've gone. With another you have strayed. Come back where you belong. Come back where you belong.
Thank you, August Waters, for a very informative presentation. Thank you to our fabulous band, Audie Blaylock and Redline. And thank you to the Boston Bluegrass Union for co-sponsoring today's Lyceum presentation. For more information about the Boston Bluegrass Union, you can visit their website at bbu.org. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at monadnocklyceum.org. The next Lyceum program will be Sunday, August 18th, and will feature Judy Wicks speaking on Good Morning, Beautiful Business, The Unexpected Journey of an Activist, Entrepreneur, and Local Economy Pioneer.